you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I can't hear myself. Some speaker, huh? I may just attach this to my beard. How's that? Pretty impressive, huh? It's so long, it often gets in the way of what I'm doing. Oh, and since we are recording this for other sex addicts to listen to, we are talking about my beard. I know how you people think. Good grief. I know because I'm one of you. And to that end, I'm going to qualify myself first. And this is something we should all have to endure. I'm going to 12th step myself in front of you. I'm going to tell you what qualifies me to be a part of this fellowship. I am powerless over my sexual behaviors once I begin them. What that means is that once I start my addictive sexual behaviors, I have little or no control over the amount of those behaviors I engage in. I have little or no control over where they stop. Once I begin, I cannot stop or moderate. I can give you some great examples. Some firm commitment that I've got 15, 20 minutes before I have to leave to get to work. And so I say to myself, oh, well, I'll just sit down and surf the internet for 15, 20 minutes. And I look at my watch and an hour has elapsed. And I'm late for work. You know, I go to one of those establishments, you know, with a firm commitment. I'm only going to spend $20. And because they have an ATM machine there, I end up emptying my bank account. And, you know, not just one massive withdrawal, $20, $20, $20, $20, $20, until it's empty, it's gone. That's what I do once I begin. I don't care what the goal is once I start. I have little or no control over where it ends. That's powerlessness. Once I begin my behaviors, once I introduce the addictive chemicals into my brain by my behaviors, I have no control over where they stop. Unmanageability, a lot of people get real confused about this. This has nothing to do with my consequences, by the way. This has to do with my brain and that I cannot stick to a decision to abstain from my addictive behaviors. Can't do it. And I always love telling this example because, you know, the next time I emptied my bank account, the next time I got caught up on my bills and I had an extra 20 bucks in my pocket, do you think I thought about the last time I went? Well, yeah, I did. I thought, well, yeah, but this time will be different. This time I'll control it. And so again, I go, I spend the $20, and I empty my bank account again. The next time I got caught up on my bills, do you think I remembered? Well, sure I remembered, but again, I said, this time I will exert more willpower, and I won't get that far again. I'll control it this time. And besides, I'm going to leave my ATM card at home. So I go, I spend the $20, and I go home. I get the ATM card and go back. Once I began, I couldn't stop. But I have a mind that won't let me remember or won't. It convinces me every time that this, just this much will be okay. Just looking at these little softcore pictures will be fine. It's not a problem. I mean, this, I can see this in public. This is not something that, you know, is considered pornography. But it's not, doesn't matter whether it's considered pornography or not. It's what my mind does with it. I get high on that first little thing. And once I start, I can't stop. But the real crux of the problem is right here in my head. I convince myself again and again that just this much is okay. And it's progressive in nature, guys. I mean, most of you can nod your heads and attest to this, that it begins with something as innocuous as the lingerie section of the Sears catalog. But then it progresses to the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. And then to that magazine, and then to the other magazine, and then to, oh my God, what am I looking at now? It's progressive in nature. It gets worse and worse all the time. Because that last thing that got me high is not going to get me high next time. It's not going to get me to where I want to be. There's a whole physiological thing behind that. Talk about it. Send me an email. I'll send you a whole bunch of stuff that's really cool. But the point is, it's progressive. Okay, so guys, I can't stop once I start. I have a mind that won't let me not start, and it's getting worse. Where's it going to end? Where's it going to end if I don't find a power that's going to stop me? Guys, I've seen my death. My death and the disease is to bleed to death on the shower room floor of a penal institution with a dozen holes in my kidneys from some homemade knife. That's why I'm going to die in this disease. Book is real clear that I got two choices. Two choices. I can live in the solution or die in the disease. There's no middle ground here. I can work this program every day like my life depends on it because you know what? It does. I have a disease that's going to kill me. The only solution I found is a daily treatment that gives me freedom. Okay, guys, when I first came to the fellowship of SAA, no one qualified me. No one sat me down and said, Ken, do you have a phenomenon of craving? Once you start, you cannot stop and moderate. Nobody said that to me. Nobody said, Ken, do you have this mental obsession that won't let you not start? No one said that to me. Guys, I did my first step sitting in front of a computer. I was sitting there clicking away, and I said to myself, I can't stop. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know anything about the obsession. I didn't know anything about the physical craving. But I did my first step right there with those three short words, I can't stop. It didn't take me going through my life history to know my truth in that moment when I could admit to myself, I'm different. Something's wrong here, and I can't fix it. That first step was shortly followed by the second step. I believed in that moment that I can't be the only one. There's got to be others out there just like me. And one of them has to have found a solution to this. I just got to find that guy and get him and shake it out of him. I did my third step when I walked in the door of my first meeting. I made a decision to do whatever it took. The steps are just that simple, guys. This is a simple program for complicated people. You know, it's not how it went exactly. I got on the internet and thought therapy was the solution. And I found a sex addiction therapist that was specialized in sex addiction, and he was local. But when I read his charges, me being the cheap son of a gun that I am, I'm not going to empty my bank account in his office. And so the receptionist said, oh, well, you need 12-step. And she referred me to the local 12-step group. Guys, my first meeting, I walked in, and it was about this dark in there. And, you know, the lights behind you guys, I can barely see your faces. That's exactly how it was when I walked in the door. You know, we've come to refer to them in my group as the dark tunnel meetings. Guys, there was no experience, strength, or hope in there. There were three other guys. One of them's older than me, and he had a scowl on his face. And I was scared of him. I didn't want to deal with that guy. I don't want anything to do with him. The other two, well, they were about my age, maybe a little younger. And when I sat down in there, they welcomed me, and I saw on the wall those 12 steps. And I saw that step 12 in there where it said, we had a spiritual awakening. I thought to myself, oh, my God, I never knew it, but this is what I've been looking for all my life. All my life I've been searching for this, and I didn't even know it. Now I have a key to get in the door. But guys, that's not what happened. No one showed me how to get through that point. And I'll go through all that. I'll talk about that. But you know, after I finished blubbering during my first meeting, puking all that stuff out about what I've been doing and all that stuff, and they're sitting there listening patiently, and that's great, that's fantastic, but nobody sat down and explained to me step one. Nobody qualified me and said, Ken, here's our problem. Do you have the same problem? No one did that. Instead, the other two younger guys, they went on to talk about how they just acted out this weekend, and they'd been in the program for years. The older guy was silent and scowling the whole time. And the thought that comes into my mind was, does this work? Because I'm not seeing any results in here. I see some guy who's miserable, who hasn't said a word, and two other guys who said they just acted out. That's all I've got from my first meeting. Nobody sat me down and said, Ken, here's the problem, here's the solution. You know, guys, what I'm talking about tonight is what is not our message. I'm going to talk about my life up until I found the solution. Yes, the solution was the steps, but no one showed me how to work the steps until later. So I did get some good advice after that first meeting. I did. The guy said, well, first off, Ken, define your sobriety and share it with two people. I did that. I'll get into the details of that in a bit. But they also said, get a sponsor. They also said, buy a big book and read it. They also said, be accountable. Now, my definition of sobriety from that first day was no self-sex, no sex outside of marriage, no exhibitionism, no voyeurism, no porn, no adult-oriented establishments, no dancing with women other than my wife. Pretty good bottom line. I shared it with two people. One of them, the guy who gave me this advice, and he complimented me. He said, Ken, that is the most incredible first attempt at defining sobriety I've ever seen. It's probably the tightest inner circle I've ever seen from a beginner. Of course, I was all pumped up and proud of myself at that point. I've got this recovery thing down. I'm Mr. Recovery. I know what I'm doing. So, got a sponsor. Went to some meetings. Saw there was a guy, had a year of sobriety. I went to him, said, will you sponsor me? He said, sure, okay. I got a sponsor, got that second thing down. Went and bought a big book, read it. Man, that's fantastic stuff. I'm not an alcoholic. And I became accountable. And guys, I think this was a real good tool early in my recovery, I really do. I got a travel log, and I kept account of where I went, when I was there, you know, what time I left, what time I arrived, how much money I spent. I got a time log from my computer, where I went, what I did, et cetera, on my computer. And I was accountable for that. I told my wife and my sponsor whenever they wanted to, they could read that. And I made a solemn commitment that no matter what, I was going to be honest with the log, even if I'd done something wrong. I made a firm commitment on that. I think that was a great tool. I think it was fantastic. But the sponsor thing, the sponsor thing, you know, I said, okay, well, what do I do? And he says, well, I want you to attend 90 meetings in 90 days. I want you to call me every day. Well, I did that. That's great. It's fantastic stuff. I did that. 90 meetings in 90 days. The meetings, boy, wasn't that interesting. The meetings, what I'm hearing in the meetings is this guy talking about what his sponsor, his therapist said. Oh, okay. So this is a program where those who can afford therapy can bring it to those who can't. Okay. All right. I bet I can do this. I'll sit here and that's what I'll do. I'll listen to them, what they learned in their therapy. Guys, let's think about this logically. Jim's a doctor, you know, and he tells me about one of his patients that has symptoms. And he tells me, you know, I have similar symptoms, but I don't tell him about it. And he tells me what the treatment he prescribes for that patient. And I go home and do that. What if I have something different and it kills me? Guys, I'm not going to take the advice of your therapist, even if I'm having symptoms that are similar to yours, because who knows, you know, doing some regression therapy might release some sort of anger and I walk in the room with a machine gun and kill everybody. That's not right. I shouldn't be trying to get well on your therapy. That's not right. But that's what I'm doing because nobody's told me any different. Nobody said anything else to me. I'm calling my sponsor every day and I'm going to 90 meetings in 90 days and I'm listening to what's going on in there. Oh, okay. So this is a meeting where people puke out their problems every day and feel a lot of relief. Okay, I can do that. I can do that, and I can get this therapy by osmosis thing. I can come in and I go, and guys, I did that, and I felt a lot of relief. But I got to tell you guys, relief is not freedom. Relief, what relief enabled me to do is not take my problems to a sponsor who would have shown me how, a good sponsor, who would have shown me how to work these steps around that problem and get freedom from it. Instead, I puke all this stuff out and I go back out into the world and guess what's there? The same problem. The same problem. Relief is not freedom. What else did I run into that? I came to it trying to learn some sort of mental or spiritual backflip that would outwit the disease. Okay, what can I get from these guys today that I can take home, put into practice, and that I can outwit this thing this time? This time I can beat it with this thing. That's not what this is about. This trick may work today or tomorrow. Guess what? I have a disease that lives in my brain. It's like playing chess with an opponent who's plugged into my head and can see my every thought. I'm not going to outsmart it ever. I may trick it a day or two, but you know what? It's going to be ahead of me the next time. You can't draw a straight line with a crooked ruler. That's what my sponsor likes to say. You can't think your way around this disease. Your brain, that's where it lives. My disease lives in my brain. I can't outthink it, period, ever. You know, I did learn a few spiritual backflips, a few intellectual, you know, muscles that I'd built up in the meetings, and I would flex them for everybody. And I became very arrogant with my recovery. And guys, by the way, that bottom line I gave you, that inner circle, I was abstinent from that in the beginning for 2 years, 8 months, and 10 days. Okay? And like I said, in those meetings, I was in there and I was flexing those spiritual muscles, all arrogant and stuff, and people come, oh, Ken, I really appreciated what you said. Guys, this program is about ego reduction. This program's about humility, not about showing off. But that's where I was. It was keeping me sick and I didn't even know it. But I thought that's what the meetings were for. Well, I need to boost my self-esteem. So when I share these really intellectual or really spiritual things and everybody says, that builds my self-esteem. You know what? That's not the issue here. I wasn't building my self-esteem. I was building my ego. It's a problem. It was keeping me sick. War stories. How can I get experience, strength, and hope from somebody's war stories? You're trying to scare me into this? Guys, it became a whole comparison thing. Mine's bigger, you know? You think your war story is something, wait to hear this. Oh, you think that's acting out. Okay? Or, oh my God, you're sick. That's not recovery, guys. You know, we got one place for our war stories. That's from the podium or sitting down with that guy, that new guy, and making an identification. And using these as an example of my powerlessness and my unmanageability and my disease progression. That's the only place for our war stories. That's the only place. We don't need to hear them in the meetings because like those guys who said they just acted out, I don't get any hope from that. What I need to hear about is not just how to be abstinent, but how to be abstinent and happy. Because guys, again, I was abstinent. And notice I didn't say sober. I was abstinent from that definition of sobriety. 2 years, 8 months, 10 days. You notice that I counted the days there? I was counting those days. Can I make it today? I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to make it today. And that's the crux of it, is that I was not here. I was hearing plenty of experience, but no strength or hope. There's no doubt that in my mind that it was not a mistake that they used a very simple little word in that phrase called "and." And what that means to me is, if I don't have any strength and hope to share, maybe I better keep my experience to myself. If I haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, maybe I better keep my mouth shut. Good grief. Guys, in the early days of AA, you didn't get to come to a meeting until somebody had said a third step prayer with you upstairs, and then you could come in. But even then, you couldn't talk until you'd finished the steps. Because you didn't have anything they wanted to hear. I don't want to know how to act out. I know how to act out. I want to know how to recover. Talk to me how to recover. That's what we need to be talking about in our meetings. So, 1 year later, I'm still abstinent. And someone asked me to sponsor him. And I told him no. And I told my sponsor about it, and he says, why not? And I said, well, don't you have to work the steps to sponsor somebody? He said, well, you don't have to complete them, you just have to stay ahead of them. And I said, well, don't you have to start them? And he says, you haven't started the steps? I've been waiting for you to tell me what to do. Guy, he wasn't my sponsor, he was my drama coach. He wasn't showing me how to do nothing. I was just calling him every day with my drama. That's it. He wasn't showing me how to do this, how to get well. So his suggestion. And this has been a long time culture in Dallas until recently. And what they do is if you need to work the steps, you start a step study. And you get a step study guide. And you get a bunch of people together with a step study guide and y'all all go through the step study guide together. Nobody in the group has to have worked the steps. That was my experience. I got a group together of almost 30 guys and we used some silly guide that I like to refer to as the easier, softer path through the steps. the self-therapy path through the steps. None of us had been through those steps before. We were the blind leading the blind. We're going through this silly guide and it's got us doing all this crazy stuff. God, you know, we spent at least six months on step one. Step one, 6 months. My God. It's torture. We went through family history. We went through addiction history. We went through abuse history. And what I got out of that was self-pity. I could blame someone else for my problem. Oh, it's not my fault I'm a sex addict. It's their fault. I can blame them. They put me here. Well, that does a lot for resentment, doesn't it? It's your fault. It's not my fault. Guys, it didn't do anything except give me more character defects. It's what therapy does for me. It just lets me mire in that fact that I wasn't nurtured as a child. Oh. Jeez. You know, 6 months before my first slip, I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. There was no doubt in my mind because I was twitchy. I couldn't sit still. I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I couldn't be happy with anything. I was twisted up and twisting in the wind. And I went around my fellowship. And I was grabbing them by the lapel and saying, show me how to do this so I don't have to act out. Well, the advice I got. Go to more meetings. Guys, I have a I did take that advice. I wasn't doing 90 meetings in 90 days. I was doing 180 meetings in 90 days. And I got to tell you, 90 meetings, 90 sick meetings of no solution in 90 days only made me 90 times sicker. Somebody tell me how to recover, please. Guys, we don't recover by the meetings we make. We recover by the steps we take. This is not a meetings program. And may the lightning not strike me. This is not a three circle fellowship. This is a 12 step fellowship. We don't recover by the three circles. We recover by the 12 steps. Three circles are a great tool, but I'm not going to get sober on them. It's just a new way to white knuckle unless I apply those steps. Plain and simple. You know, the other advice I got was call my sponsor more often. Call more program buddies. I'm calling my sponsor every day. I'm making two program phone calls a day. Work, do more step work. I'm doing an hour's worth of step work every night. You know, two program phone calls a day, sponsor every day, two meetings a day. I don't have time to scratch my ear. I much less act out. But I was still restless, irritable, and discontented. It wasn't enough to be abstinent. Can you show me how to be abstinent and happy? Nobody was doing that. They were telling me to go to more sick meetings. They were telling me to make more phone calls. They had no purpose other than, I'm really struggling. Okay, well, at least you admitted it, Ken. Great. I admitted I'm struggling. Does that solve? It doesn't solve nothing. You know, someone else, and something that I kept hearing in our meetings, one of the things we have in our readings is that the key to recovery is working the 12 steps with a sponsor. And that's what was missing in my program. So I took that same guide, and the guy that wrote that guide trains sex addiction therapists. And my sponsor is a trained, by this guy, sex addiction therapist. And so I did get him to sit down with me and that guide a few times. I had to beg him. And I read to him the same answers that I was getting in that step study. And his response was, good answer. Great, what do I have you for? Guys, this is not self-therapy. This is not secondhand therapy. This is not a program of relief. Not a program of three circles. It's a program of action. I have to work the steps. What I found, well, we'll get into that tomorrow. What I'm talking about you tonight is what not our message. Guys, there were... I don't think I could have stayed sober 2 years, 8 months, and 10 days unless I did have some spiritual growth during that time. Only problem was I didn't have a system for consistent spiritual growth because my disease is progressing whether I'm sober or not. I have to grow spiritually, outpace the growth of that disease. What I didn't have was a system for daily spiritual growth. I did have some incredible experiences, but they weren't as a result of the 12 steps. About 8 weeks into my recovery, into my coming to the fellowship, I'm sitting down and I'm watching, this string duet at the mall, drinking a cup of coffee, and, a plainclothes police officer comes up and arrests me, or asks me to come with him. And I, being a good citizen and wanting to help the police, I say, sure, I followed him, and he proceeded to arrest me, and I asked, well, what I do wrong? He says, well, Mr. Clark, you were exposing yourself in public and now you're being arrested for indecent exposure. And I go, what? Hey guys, I thought for a minute, did the definition change suddenly and nobody told me about it? Is there some large hole in my clothing that I'm somehow blind to that everyone else can see? Yeah, I began to question reality, really. Really, I began to question my own sanity. But guys, there was a lot of things that happened out of that I knew God was present in my life. I was in a tank with a bunch of guys who had tattoos and weird haircuts and gold teeth, and they were scary. I had 200 guys in that tank. And each one of them asking me, why are you here? The truth was, and I said this, I don't know. I don't know what happened. I'm not sure. You know, I talked to, one thing I learned in that tank was there's an elemental truth. Sometimes the only thing between us and our addiction is God. Because I didn't have access to a phone. I couldn't talk freely to my sponsor. Didn't have the steps to rely on. I didn't have any meetings that I could attend in that tank. Couldn't call any program buddies. Couldn't do anything except pray. And I got to tell you guys, I was on the horn with God pretty much the moment I walked in the door. Okay, so in the tank, and I get through that night, and that told me right then, you know what? I can count on my God to get me through anything, because He got me through probably one of the worst nights of my life. Okay, you know, get a lawyer, $6,000 in legal fees. I took it to trial because, you know, I could have paid a $500 fine, pled no contest, and had it erased from my record after a period of probation. But you know what? It wasn't the truth. I can't have people telling lies on me. I've got to stand up for the truth, even when it's standing up for me. I have to stand up for the truth. So I fought it, took it to court before a jury of my peers. I was acquitted. But guys, while the jury was out and nobody knew which way it was going to go, I was coming back from calling my wife, and the accusing officer was coming out of the courtroom, and there was nobody else in that foyer that's usually crowded with a good 100 people. We were alone, and we were going to pass each other. And as I passed him, there were daggers coming out of my eyes. This guy's cost me $6,000 in legal fees, and no telling what's going to happen if that jury finds me guilty. But as I passed him, I realized, this is not what God wants for me. This is not what God wants me to do. This is not part of what He wants me to be. And so I turned around and I called the officer's name, and he turned and he looked at me and said, yes. And he says, this is hard for me, but God wants me to forgive you for what you've done. And I do. And it's going to take a long time, but I'm starting right here. And of course, you know, whatever his deal. Okay. Walked off. If the jury had come back and said I was guilty, that would have had a different meaning. If the jury had come back and said I was innocent, it would have had a different meaning. But at the exact moment when it would have had no other meaning other than I am forgiving you, God put me alone with that guy in a place that's normally crowded. I don't know what happened. I don't know what the result was of that. That's none of my darn business. That's God's problem. But you know, the truth is, there was design. There was design. I knew at that moment, God was doing something in my life. I don't know what, but He's doing something. I'm part of the plan. I'm a delivery truck driver, but I'm part of the plan. That guy in Pompeii who was sweeping the streets the day before Vesuvius blew, guess what? He was part of the plan. I don't know what part of the plan he played, but he was part of it. I could see from that incident, there's God's at work in my life. I don't know what He's doing, but I got to trust He's there. Some other spiritual growth I experienced. You know, right about that time, I was working at a job that, it was a nightmare. Individual proprietorship. I'm working with the wife and the owner and the owner's girlfriend, and the wife doesn't know about the girlfriend, and I'm there, and it's freaking me out. I'm trying to stay on the straight and narrow, and there's all this chaos going on around me, and I can't stand it. I need to change jobs, and I need to do it now. The job I applied for, I ended up taking a 45% pay cut to take it. And that night, Trish and I sat down, and we prayed about it, and we talked about it, and we made that decision. I was in a load of fear. And God, I wish somebody had showed me how to work these steps at that time, because I would have had some tools to deal with fear. But instead, I got stuck with my fear and no drug to sedate it and no program tools, the 12 steps, to deal with it. So instead, I had to face the fear of changing careers, changing jobs, taking a 45% pay cut. Oh, my God, what's going to happen to us? We're going to lose the house. I don't know what. But we trusted. That night, my wife recognized what was going on. I didn't know what was going on, but I had a pain in my intestines. It felt like I had swallowed shards of glass and they were being drugged through my intestines. I felt like I was bleeding internally. My wife recognized it. I was having an anxiety attack. And I told her, I don't feel right. And she said, well, you're not bleeding. You know, if that were the case, you'd be going to the bathroom and bleeding and so on and so forth. And so, let's sit with it and see what happens. You look okay. And so we got through it. I got through it. The next morning I woke up. And what I learned from that moment is I don't have to be afraid of feeling afraid. I don't have to be afraid of fear. For that matter, I don't have to be afraid of anger. I don't have to be afraid of remorse that I've been dodging for all my life. I don't have to be afraid of feeling those things. Feeling them is not going to kill me, though I thought it was. I thought it was killing me. What else did I learn? Right about the same time, first 90 days of recovery, that's withdrawal. And I'm white-knuckling it. I'm thinking about that. I'm white-knuckling it. Ken, you're holding on to something. What are you holding on to? You're holding on to the steering wheel. What are you steering? Your life. You haven't turned your will and your life over to the care of God. Oh, that means I need to let Him drive. If I'm white-knuckling, I'm still controlling things. I had to learn that I have to be French. I surrender. That's some of the spiritual growth I experienced. Guys, a lot of people tell me, well, Ken, you put down your meetings all the time. You put down your local fellowship all the time. You say that recovery wasn't there. The problem is you. You should have put your butt in the chair and just sat there. Guys, honest. Recovery was not present in Dallas. Honest. 2004, the ISO planned a convention in Dallas. And some of you know this. Traditionally, when they plan a convention in a city, the fellowship for that city steps up and does all the legwork. They do all the planning work. They do all the facilitating, getting all the workshops ready. So guess what? Dallas didn't do that. They knew Dallas wouldn't do that. They had groups from other cities planning a convention in Dallas because they knew the Dallas fellowship would not step up and do service work. Why? Recovery's not in Dallas. That's why they planned the convention there, to bring recovery to Dallas. Now, I went to the convention, and I'm talking to some people that actually work this program, not the fellowship, the program. And I'm seeing what it's really all about. And I go back to my meetings, I go back to my fellowship, and I realize I need a new sponsor. This ain't working. I've had this guy for almost 3+ years. This just ain't working. And so I fired him. And he knew it was coming because he wouldn't meet with me and work the steps with me. So I'm looking around at my fellowship, and I'm looking for another sponsor. And this guy over here has years of abstinence, but he's still restless, irritable, and discontented. this guy over here, he's abstinent, but he hasn't worked a step in his life. This guy over here is abstinent, but he still wants to use that silly guide that got me nowhere with someone who was trained to use it. I'm looking at this guy over here, and he's got everything I want, but he's acting out all the time. I couldn't find a sponsor in my local fellowship. It wasn't happening there. And guys, when they did appear to be abstinent, and they did appear to be working the steps, and when they, why is it when that guy hugs me that I feel like I need to take a shower? Something's not right here. Guys, we don't stay sober by the meetings we make. We stay sober by the steps we take. This is not a three-circle fellowship. It's a 12-step fellowship. We need to be responsible in our meetings. And when that new guy comes in, and if we start talking about outside issues like therapy, guess what? He's going to get a little confused about what's going on. And it might be that much longer before he finds the truth. This is why we don't talk about outside issues in our program. We talk about our program of recovery in our fellowship. You want to talk about some other program of recovery? Go to some other fellowship. I'm not knocking those programs of recovery. They're great, but they're not 12-step. We have a singleness of purpose. We have one message. We recovered. We had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. We have responsibility to sit down. That guy who is sober, who's abstinent, has never worked a step in his life. Guess what? He's probably not one of us. He's probably just someone who got caught with his hand in the cookie jar and is just trying to keep his wife off his back. Going to meetings. And you know what? When he sponsors somebody that is one of us, and he says, oh, I've never worked those steps, what do you think is going to happen? We need to take responsibility for our fellowship and find out. That guy, if he says he has the desire to stop addictive sexual behaviors for good and all, he has a right to occupy one of our chairs. But we have the right to grab him up afterwards and say, you're welcome to sit here, but don't you raise your hand during sponsorship. Don't you offer to sponsor anyone. And in fact, until you work the steps, you got no experience, strength, and hope for us. So you keep your mouth shut while you sit in our chairs. You come here, keep your wife off your back all you want. But until you work our program, you got nothing we want. You're welcome to attend. You're welcome to put a dollar in our basket. That's up to you. But you know what? We don't want you sponsoring anybody, and we don't want you carrying somebody else's message. Our message is that we had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. If you didn't do that, shut up. We have a responsibility in this fellowship to make sure when that newcomer comes in, he hears the truth. Otherwise, he's going to stay sick. He's going to think that this is a program of relief. And I tell you, there are so many in this fellowship that think that relief is a spiritual awakening. It's not. Relief is relief. It's temporary. It goes away. So too does a spiritual awakening. But you know what? That relief goes away the second I go back out and see that problem's waiting there for me. Freedom is daily freedom. But you know what? When I go out and face that problem, it's not a problem anymore. Guys, this part of the program, this part of what I want to talk about is what is not recovery and how many years I squandered in this fellowship not finding a solution because of all the stuff that's being talked about in our meetings that's not 12-step. I was talking to somebody earlier. You know where this program began? 8 therapists and a judge. Tell me some outside issues didn't bleed in. Guys, that's 8 therapists and a judge. It's not an asset. It's a hurdle. And we're still trying to get over that thing. We got so much outside issue in our fellowship, it's ridiculous. Somebody comes into my meeting and starts talking about inner child work, I'm going to say, whoa, take that therapy stuff to your therapist. And here, tell me how you work the 12 steps. Oh, you haven't worked the 12 steps. Maybe you could listen to those of us who have. Because you don't have what we want. Question is, do we have what you want? If we don't, fine, no problem. Where's the door? We love you. You're welcome to sit in our meetings as long as you want. So long as you say that you want to abstain from addictive sexual behaviors. But you know what? Keep your mouth shut until you know what you're talking about. Because what you're saying could kill somebody. And guys, if you don't, but this is one of the number one things that we struggle with in this fellowship, is the lethality of this disease. Few people understand. Guys, in my local fellowship, I have seen it kill people. I've seen guys who were years abstinent, going to meetings, go out and kill themselves. One guy, after he left a meeting, he drove up into the driveway of his house and put a gun in his mouth and blew his brains out. It's not enough to abstain. How do I happily abstain? Because if I don't find a way to do that, that's what I'm going to do. Guys, I've made two promises to God in my life. The first one got me into the fellowship. The second one made me seek recovery. The second promise I made to God was that I'd never cheat on my wife, and I was about to. And I said, this is crazy. This is insane. I'm nuts, and I got to stop. I got to find a solution. That brought me here. But I didn't find a way out. I didn't find a way out till 4 years later. I sat for 4 years in misery on the verge of breaking the first promise that I ever made to God, and that was that I would never again put a gun in my mouth. Some people haven't made that promise. And I got to tell you what, I've seen hundreds, literally hundreds, nay, thousands come into the rooms, show up for a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, and then they disappear. And I don't know what happened to them. And I think about this. No, I'm not responsible for what they did or didn't get in the meetings. But I am responsible for telling the truth in the meeting. And if they're not hearing the truth in the meeting, what's going to keep them from going out and seeking the final solution? For the truth, I am responsible. No, I can't save their life. They may still go kill themselves even if I do tell the truth. But you know what? I'm not going to have it sitting on my conscience that they killed themselves because they didn't hear the truth. Because they didn't hear about a solution. You know, another girl in the program hung herself in her apartment. She was years abstinent, attended meetings regularly. Meetings are not our solution. The steps are. Guys, right now I am sober since December 17th of 05. And what you've heard about tonight is up until the point where I found a solution. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to close it here and let you guys think about what we're doing in our meetings, whether we're honoring those traditions or not. Tomorrow I'll tell you what I found, because what you heard tonight was experience. Tomorrow I'll give you some strength and hope. My strength and hope. But I want to leave you with this solemn thought that us telling a bunch of horse manure in our meetings, it's not helping people stay alive. Plain and simple. And with that, I'll turn it back over to our master of ceremonies. I tell them straight out, front forward, that if I'm going to sponsor them, that what I'm doing is I'm training them to be a sponsor. And if they don't sponsor people the way I sponsor people, I don't know how to work that program. I don't know how to work your program. I know how to work the program that keeps me sober. You balk, you give me any grief about any of the directions. That's your program. I'm going to say, good luck. Go Go find someone who knows how to work it. But I don't. I'm not going to gamble with your life on a program that I don't know how to work. I didn't repeat the question. The question was, is there anything specific I have a new protege do or say to them whenever I first agree to sponsor them? Any other questions? Wow. Oh. Eddie. Am I cool with a newcomer asking questions in a meeting? We have that happen in our meetings. And what I say is, let's get with you after the meeting. We'll sit down with you after the meeting and we'll tell you about all of that. You can ask as many questions as you want then. But right now, we're going to focus on how to work these steps. Anyone else? The question is, what our meetings are like. Are they not discussion meetings? Guys, I'm on the outreach, general outreach committee. And when we got the teen outreach subcommittee going, Tom said, I think Ken should chair. And what I heard was, I think Ken should share. And I thought to myself, God, I hate discussion meetings. What am I going to say? And then I realized what he told me. Guys, I hate discussion meetings because so much outside issue. Guys, my personal problems are an outside issue. What we want in our meetings should be classrooms for how to stay alive by working these steps. My meeting, I only attend big book studies now. I just, unless there's some sort of special thing at some discussion meeting where I have a protege doing something, I need to support him. I need to get his back. Now when we go to discussion meetings, we play Noah's Ark. We go in twos. So when somebody gets out of line and starts discussing some stuff that doesn't belong in our meetings, one person can raise his hand and say, that's an outside issue. And when somebody else starts saying, hey, well, but he can talk about anything he wants in it, the other one can step across the room and say, no, guys, he's right. That's an outside issue. We team up when we go to discussion meetings because we've got to cover each other's back. It also keeps us accountable for not getting self-righteous. And I hate discussion meetings because God has yet to remove that self-righteousness defect from me. And I struggle with it a lot. So the meetings I attend are big book studies. That's how I recovered. That's been the most successful approach to the 12 steps in the history of the 12 steps. So. That's what I got. Does that answer your question? Okay, yellow shirt. Jim? Is it? A formal first step. Do we do formal first steps in our meetings? The meetings that I no longer attend still do. Group in England brought up something very pertinent in the Green Book Revision Committee. And that is that formal first steps are against our fifth tradition. They do not carry a message of experience, strength, and hope. They talk about how I acted out. If I told one of my proteges who still wanted to do a formal first step, I said, that's fine, you can do that. After you've worked all 12 steps, and if you can make, 60% of it, you're acting out, and 40% of it, what your life is like now. That's called a speaker meeting. Okay, John.
What did you think of our meeting this morning?
John asked what I thought of our meeting this morning. Did you remember my check-in? I said I was agitated and asking for the right thought or action. I don't like discussion meetings because I hear so many things that are not 12-step. And the newcomer, I cringe when he hears stuff. And I wonder, what part is he taking to heart? What part is he hearing? If only the 12-step is spoken about, we know he's only hearing 12-step. Guys, the reason for our meetings is that newcomer. That's the only reason they exist. The only purpose of a meeting is where a newcomer can come to find experience, strength, and hope. And for an old-timer to find a newcomer to work with. It's a hookup place. Protégés, sponsors. It's the only purpose. Okay, your name?
Carol.
Carol, go ahead, Carol. What do I think about feelings, checks, and check-ins? I think that that's better suited for calling my sponsor because he's going to ask me, why do you feel resentful? Because you need to find out what character defects are driving that resentment. You need to find out what character defects are driving that fear. Because when I do my feelings check-ins with my sponsor, when I do any kind of check-in with my sponsor, he's going to show me how to work the steps to solve the problem. Instead of me just dumping it in a meeting where no one tells me how to solve the problem because of our, what is it, our crosstalk rules. Okay, and it's
Edward,
okay. Okay.
What are your thoughts, I guess, in terms of someone who that may have worked 12 steps in a program like AA, but still has a problem with sex, so they come to an AA?
I sponsor alcoholics all the time. The steps are the steps. There are some nuances, yes. You know, the main difference between what we were talking, Jim and I talking about, he's probably talking to get in touch with Burns and get in the discussion, the difference between alcoholics and sex addicts. My conception of this is the difference between a sex addict and alcoholic. Alcoholic has to go to the liquor store or the bar. Sex addict has to close his eyes. You know, the big book says that we can go anywhere provided that we have a good reason for being there and we're in fit spiritual condition. Okay, that means he could go into a bar if he's got a good reason for being there and in fit spiritual condition. Where's my bar? Yeah, alcoholics have to work a program. They can afford some selfishness, self-pity, dishonesty here and there. I can't because I'm in the bar 100% of the time. I've got to work twice, three times the program. They do. Solution is the same. I just have to sweat at it. Speaking of which. Okay, back there in the back. Keith. How would I describe the health of SAA in Dallas and how would I describe the health of SAA nationally? Dallas still has its sick meetings. The majority of them are sick meetings. There are a few meetings that are focused on the solution where once there were none. It's getting better, but those of us who focus on the solution are considered, step Nazis or nut jobs, and they avoid us. And in fact, had a COSA approach me and say, Ken, the reason we won't send our husbands to your meetings is because we think y'all are a bunch of step Nazis. And I said, good, because I don't want a bunch of middle-of-the-roaders in my meeting. I want people who are serious about recovery. And if my reputation keeps those people who aren't desperate away from me, awesome. I only want people who are desperate. The B, nationally. Guys. It's on tape. the question was, do they want me to stop the recording? I think there's a lot of outside issues in our fellowship nationally. Like I said, this program started with 8 therapists and a judge. And we are trying to overcome that hurdle and meeting resistance all the way. There are people who know what this program is about in key positions. But guys, if we're going to take this fellowship back from the therapists, we need all of you. We need all of you to not just voice, but to work the steps, have a spiritual awakening, and get your butts out there and help someone else work the steps and have a spiritual awakening. We need to build an army because we got a tidal wave coming our way. Pat C. and I agree on one thing, and that's the tidal wave. But that's about it. George. The question is, and let me see if I'm saying this right, George. AA had incredible success at this point, 30 years into their program, into their existence. They had incredible success, whereas we have nothing compared to that. Is that because we start with 8 therapists and a judge? Is that your question? I would say singleness of purpose. Yes, I would say absolutely that they stuck to one program of recovery. And they, you know, Dr. Bob's last words was, let's not louse this thing up. Let's not bring a bunch of psychobabble into this thing. This program is simple. Love and service. Okay? Now, psychobabble. Freudian complexes. Inner child. And we don't need it. We got God. Does that kind of answer your question? Okay. On top of that, the reason AA was successful, the reason that it gained wide acceptance, you check the forward to your second edition, it says because of the large number of recoveries. Why did they have a large number of recoveries? Because they worked the steps. They stuck to the one program that worked for them. During those first 20 years of AA, all they had was that book. They stuck to that book. And you look at those success rates and your jaw drops. You look at any archive in the Cleveland area, they had like a 98% success rate during those first 20 years. Okay. Yes. You know, in that disclosure paragraph, it talks about that no rule can be made. But we found this is the best course of action to take, and that is that if she doesn't know, should she? Not always. If she knows we've been wild in a general way, certainly we should admit our faults, which is our character defects. But if she wants to know specifics, we have no right. The program is very clear. It says in the fifth step, and this applies to all steps, is that I have no right to say something to my wife or parents that would hurt them. I don't have a right to clean my own conscience on someone else's soul. Thanks, honey. That's real considerate. Yeah. Guys, if it means I'm going to get a divorce, guess what? If I cause a harm that causes me to act out later, I'm going to get a divorce anyway. If I do a harm that causes me remorse and I go act out over that, I've lost the marriage anyway. So I'm going to lose the marriage or I'm not going to lose the marriage. That's God's problem. Guys, we're not in the marriage saving business. Sorry, Kosas. We're not here to save your marriage. We're here to stay sober. And if that means we're going to do some things you don't like, TS. I mean, too bad. Anyone else? Tom? No. Cut it. All right. Turn it over to...
Thank you.